For our next session, we are in debt both to the kindness of the composers who have agreed to be with us today, and also to Mr. Michael Kirker of ASCAP, who has arranged this panel for us. There's one alteration to the program as printed, and that is that Ms. Ann Rennell will not be able to be with us. But Edward Eliscu, Gerald Marks, Ms. Dana Suisse, we're very pleased to have with us today, and Martin Williams, who will moderate the panel, will present some excerpts from very long discographies and biographies of these three eminent composers. Our next panel.
I will, with the permission of the participants, introduce each separately. And Mr. Marks has requested that he go first, I think because he's got a real job after this and has to rush off to, which is the reason that, unfortunately for us all, Mr. Rennell is not here. Most people who are involved with jazz, as I am, know Gerald Marks because of All of Me, which is a song almost everybody knows, and certainly every important jazz singer for the last 30 years has recorded, and many, many other kinds of singers as well. People who know that and associated him with that may not know that he also wrote Is It True What They Say About Dixie? And That's What I Want for Christmas. And at the invitation of Carl Sandburg, for George London, who recorded it, Mr. Lincoln and His Gloves. He was associated with some illustrious shows, Broadway shows from the early 30s and mid-30s, like My Dear Public and Ziegfeld Follies and White Horse Inn, which was a fabled show of my childhood and youth. Every other song on the radio for a couple of years seemed to come from that show somehow, and cast members as well, and Hold It. And he has an ecumenical career, which can certainly rival Irving Berlin's. This series of songs for 10 Jewish holidays, 10 Catholic holy days, 10 Protestant days, all each approved by the religions concerned, followed by something we can all share, 9 holidays for Americans. Well, you see, we only get 9 when we get together, but separately we have 10, provided we're religious, I suppose. And an ABC, the ABC stories of Jesus, that which is quite remarkable, because that was followed by a selection of songs for B'nai B'rith's boys' organizations, Today and Tomorrow, and girls' organization, Give Me Your Hand. May I present Gerald Marks.
Piano. This is the first time in my long career that I have ever appeared anywhere without a piano. And how a songwriter does a song without a piano is a mystery. I wish somebody in the audience would tell you. But nevertheless, that's what it is. So half of what I was going to do, I will have to just delete, because to sing here, stand here, and sing a cappella is not my forte. So here's a songwriter who will talk instead of playing his song. Where I come from.
May I ask you to get mic'd?
No, they can hear me. No,
but we can't record you for posterity.
Oh, posterity? Mm-hmm. All right, Martin.
Come closer, I don't have much wire. Posterity.
This is for posterity. Now I'd better be careful of the words I use. I started to say that Tin Pan Alley, our home, songwriter's home, is shorthand for an American institution, the popular song, one of the graces of life that occasionally electrifies the world and more often vexes the critics, an area of divine madness and uncontrollable pandemonium, a pencil of land in New York City, wall to wall with songwriters, music publishers, recording angels, assorted singers and performers, all speaking our own lingua franca, hangers-on from everywhere, a polyglot like Broadway at theater time. Sometimes it seems the immediate world is engaged in songwriting. Bank presidents, streetwalkers, every racetrack type, a hot watch salesman, saints and sinners, but at the same time priests of imagination, a hodgepodge of all creeds, colors, nationalities, each with a tune, a lyric, an idea. An area short on theory, devoid of prejudice and envy, where love is the predominant pet theme. Legit, platonic, holy, sinful. It is a solemn and religious duty in Tin Pan Alley to pay tribute to the divine madness of love in as many songs as you possibly can. A songwriter, usually born of mystic passion and profound guts, learns quickly that shrinking timidity kills. Having elevated his song to the stature of a hit even before the ink is dry on the manuscript, he demonstrates his brand new opus for the publisher or record man or performer, who immediately recognizes hit potentialities in this hot-off-the-brain piece of merchandise, the publisher proclaiming, if I let him publish my song, he will take it to the pinnacle of charts around the world. The publisher or record man lives up to his promise. My song becomes a flashing sensation. My bank account runneth over far beyond the FDIC maximum. My publisher takes me to dinner and permits me to dance with his wife. God is in Empyrean. I am proclaimed the new Irving Berlin. ASCAP and Tin Pan Alley are at my feet, a ticket to heaven. That's Tin Pan Alley. That's also a bald lie. There are no Solomons or Delphic oracles who can prophesy a hit or a miss. No one knows a trailblazing song or a record until the marketplace has given it the acid test. No one knows whether to lampoon or deliver a panegyric. There is no Beatrice to lead you to the light. In fact, there's no such one place as Tin Pan Alley. The ancient regime is gone. A vanquished world. Once upon a time in the West 20s, 30s, 40s, in New York City, yes. Now, no. The scene I just described is dispersed. Today, the country is one franchise. The proliferation of radio, TV, and record companies with their voracious appetite for new material, add Nashville, add the West Coast. Peripatetic recording artists in cafes and concerts plugging their records, their albums. These have made it unnecessary many times for the songwriter to travel further than his backyard to get his song a hearing. All the writer has to do today is go backstage with his piece of tape, grab the performer by the earrings, by the beads or by the beard, and start the tape rolling. Shakespeare said, four boards and a passion constitute a theater. Paraphrasing that a bit, there is no chalk marking of the stage where someone must write a song. Wherever a kid or adult is scratching notes and syllables on a piece of paper, there is Tin Pan Alley. And songwriters like the kudzu vine grow in every kind of soil. Does an idea for a tune or a line start upon a marathon and run around your brain? You're in Tin Pan Alley, sure as you're born. Yet despite all the new inventions, a few things haven't changed from the beginning. Someone still has to compose, someone has to promote, someone has to like it well enough to record it, broadcast it, buy it. This presentation will not reek of dollar signs, numbers of copies or records sold. No deals, no business mergers, no statistics. That subject is for the computer core. I deal in the human interest side of my field, the sometime backstage eccentricities rather than the mundane. A field in which a hit can alter one's psychic apparatus and you spring forth full grown like Athena from the head of Zeus. Or stated another way, you star for a brief moment in a rose-colored spotlight. And let me add that the fantasies one encounters in song, in songs, often are more attractive and preferable than life's realities. Now, one of the most important ingredients of a songwriting career is the four-letter word luck, fickle fluke. The freaks of chance have the edge. It's the meat and gristle of the business. Nothing is determinable by calculation. The reason? Economics, supply and demand. Radio, TV, and the recording industry can handle only so many songs, and talent sprouts from under every rock in America. Indeed, songwriters are challenging rabbits in the multiplication tables. Take your time. Ergo, the competition is unimaginably keen. One assumes the embryonic songwriter has a modicum of talent, but unless he's a certified genius, luck is the determinant, fortune is the mistress. But giving advice to a youngster who has his heart set on a songwriting career is meaningless. How can he know that he might attain the eminence of a pharaoh or shoot a blank? How can he know that many are called but few are chosen? That there are many casualties in the stampede, and that gold is seldom discovered on Parnassus, that enthusiasm and ambitions are not the result of divine revelation. So only green youth takes the risks full time. No salary, no bonuses, no guarantees, no rules, no sanctified routines, no prescriptions. And every day, a different set of situations. I always hesitate to give advice anyway. I cannot erase from my mind the picture of the young student who, when asked to write a short essay on Socrates, wrote, "Socrates was a man who went around giving advice. They poisoned him." My the first song that is without a piano. I will never forget this as long as I live. My first song was written in my hometown of Saginaw, Michigan, on a piece of wrapping paper. I had never seen manuscript paper in my town. And the letter that accompanied it was also on wrapping paper, and it was to the only name at that time, I was 14 years old, that I had heard of in the music business, and that was Irving Berlin. And so my letter ran something like this: Dear Mr. Berlin, I am enclosing here with my latest song. Now that was to fool Berlin that I was already a professional songwriter. And the next line, as I recall, read, I know when you go over my song, you will realize I am loaded with talent. That line proved that I already had one necessary ingredient for a songwriting career, known as chutzpah. And I closed the letter with, please let me hear from you. You and I could make a lot of money together. Now, a cappella. I don't know how this song will go over. If you don't, well, I won't say it, because I've never done it without a piano, and I don't even know where the key is. Or, well, anyway, I will say this, that the song is still available. I think I'll start there. That's a pretty good note, isn't it, Dana? They've written songs about every state. Some were rotten, some were great. Some should not have gotten off the shelf. But the thing that always makes me sore, they missed the state that I adore. So I've had to write it myself. North Dakota, why don't they write about you? North Dakota, you're hard to rhyme, that is true. And though you have no minstrels humming and no banjo strumming, you ought to get what's coming to you. North Dakota, you and your wonderful wife. South Dakota, I've loved you both all my life. And if they ask me what's the greatest state in all these famous 48, I'll tell them it's you, California. I'll never do that again. The creative life, especially that of the musical creator, is an exercise in scaled chaos, where accidentals are the norm, where after you believed your ditty would appear on the A side of the record, you find it on the flip or flop side, rarely to be heard. You bleed for a split second, your euphoria dampened, but bounce out of your depression when you remember you will receive the same amount of money as the hit on the A side. Recalling swiftly that even modern technology does not yet permit the buyer to purchase one side of a pancake. Let me illustrate. The biggest song I ever had was If It Doesn't Snow on Christmas. I hear no applause. It's a good bet that it ranks high on the list of the most unsung songs in the history of music. At the time, I not only expected it to hit, I envisioned an irresistible explosion, but it landed on the flip side of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. And to my knowledge, no one has ever turned that record over to play my pretty, pretty song. You will understand that songwriters very soon get accustomed to dying frequently. All right, this is about a song and I can't do it. Can't sing it without some accompaniment. My colleagues and I wrote a song with the unlikely title, The Rooster, just ring a bell when you want me off. Because, you know, I could go on for years. We wrote a song with the unlikely title, The Rooster's Crowin' Cock-a-Doodle-Doo. And true to the songwriter's credo, I immediately labeled it a song I labeled it the Song of Songs. A song which in my daydreaming combined all the resources of human wisdom and talent. While still feverishly hot and perched on the ceiling, a letter was composed to Al Jolson, suggesting he perform the song on his weekly radio program from the coast. The letter testifying to the virtues of Cock-a-Doodle-Doo, predicting it would be an artillery shot heard round the world, that it would flash to all music lovers in 48-point bold. In short, a drop-dead song. Letter signed. One of my collaborators remembered a number we had written a couple of years before, one I considered voiceless and fleshless and detested with a fury and hoped was buried in the files for all time, called Is It True What They Say About Dixie, insisting we enclose it along with Cock-a-Doodle-Doo. No, I argued, the word Dixie is pure corn today. It's weak at the seams. Hasn't been used in a song since Jolson got off his knees at the Winter Garden. Sure fire rubbish. I closed the clamor by yapping if Jolson, through some shocking error, should sing this lousy Dixie trash, the South would take revenge and rise again. This misbegotten bunch of words and notes would scare the angel of pity, and the song wouldn't last to the spring equinox. But Rooster is the knee plus ultra in songwriting. It could enliven your glands and enrich your social life. And I tossed in the unasked for opinion that New York songwriters should never write songs about the South anyway, because few of them had ever traveled further south than 14th Street here in Manhattan. But solus contra mundum, one against the world. You're entitled to your own dogmatic ignorance, I said in a doloroso mood. And after some eloquent vituperation, a postscript was added stating that as a bonus for introducing Cock-a-Doodle-Doo, we were enclosing a piece of satirical material with which Jolson could have fun at Hollywood parties. I was hesitant about calling it a song. In fact, I would have wanted Kafka to get the credit and hoped a higher wisdom would prevail. Dixie, my words delicately flavored with contempt, belongs in a thrift shop. It's a basket case. To myself, I said, cock-a-doodle-doo will gain me admittance to the Illuminati of music. It'll peel the varnish off the kitchen table. It could walk on water. Jolson wired promptly, listen in this week. Full of hopped up hope, I tuned in 8 o'clock, sure that the following morning, Rooster would make me the biggest name in Tin Pan Alley and solvent. Take your time. My veins collapsed in terror when the star introduced the next smash hit and sang me into immortality temporarily. Now, at this point, I usually sing the song, but I'm not, I don't think it's necessary, is it? If anybody plays this, I hope they put on Jolson's record right at this point. And I'll do the verse for you too, which nobody knows. I think I'm the only one. People brag, people boast, and consistently drink a toast to a place that a lot of them place at the top of the list. Are they wrong? Are they right? Is there reason for their delight? I must live in doubt till the day that I find out. Is it true what they say about Dixie? Does the sun really shine all the time? Do the sweet magnolias blossom round everybody's door? Do the folks keep eating possum till they can't eat no more? Is it true what they say about Swanee? Is a dream by that stream so sublime? Do they laugh? Do they love like they say in every song? If it's true, that's where I belong. I do one more. The bell has rung, but as always in the songwriting business, there are no rules. And so I'll ignore the bell for just a couple of seconds and tell you about one accident I had in the music business, and that was bringing in from my hometown in Michigan a song called All of Me. And this is not an outstanding story, because every songwriter in the world can tell part of this story. It was turned down by everybody along the street. No publisher wanted it. And I went back home Friday night with the manuscript in my pocket. Back in my hometown, there was a little vaudeville house, and at that moment, there was a woman by the name of Belle Baker, tremendous star in her, vaudeville star in her day. And in desperation, I knocked on her dressing room door, and she let me in. She let me in because it was Saginaw, Michigan, and she was lonesome. And take it from me, you can be lonesome in Saginaw, Michigan. Otherwise, I never would have gotten in to see her. She needed another song like I needed a hole in my head. She had a little piano there, and I rolled it up to where she was making up at her dressing room. She sang it one night, gave one performance on a newspaper man's interview show in Manhattan right here. There was no network, and she sang it, on a Saturday night, and Monday morning there were calls in all the stores for a song called All of Me, and no publisher had it. That's the worst. I wish every songwriter in the world that he has a hit started and no publisher has it. Now, I came into town when it was a hit about 3 months later, and she's laying off that week. And I asked her that night, Belle, why did you cry so the day I played that song for you in Michigan? And she said, I thought you knew. I said, knew what? She said, 6 weeks before you walked in with that song, I buried my husband. And when you came to the lines, your goodbye left me with eyes that cry, how can I go on, dear, without you? And you took the part that once was my heart. Why not take? I couldn't stand it. I saw him in front of me, and I see him in front of me every time I walk on the stage and sing the song. So my point is this. He's crying. She sang it one night, gave one performance on a newspaper man's interview show in Manhattan right here. There was no network. And she sang it on a Saturday night, and Monday morning there were calls in all the stores for a song called All of Me, and no publisher had it. That's the worst. I wish every songwriter in the world that he has a hit started and no publisher has it. Now, I came into town when it was a hit about 3 months later, and she's laying off that week. And I asked her that night, Belle, why did you cry so the day I played that song for you in Michigan? And she said, I thought you knew. I said, knew what? She said, 6 weeks before you walked in with that song, I buried my husband. And when you came to the lines, your goodbye left me with eyes that cry, how can I go on, dear, without you? And you took the part that once was my heart. Why not take? I couldn't stand it. I saw him in front of me, and I see him in front of me every time I walk on the stage and sing the song. So my point is this. A songwriter's career can hang on a little silken thread. A man had to die so that I could have a career. Thank you very, very much.
Would you be able to stay and take questions at the end, or do you need to leave?
No, yeah. I'll stay.
Yeah, sure. Would you have seat back there? Not only do we have an important songwriter, I have a feeling we may have discovered an important comedian. He knew it long ago, and so did all previous members of his audiences, I'm sure. Our next guest is an illustrious lady songwriter, Dana Suisse. You will know songs that she's been associated with, like My Silent Love, You Ought to Be in Pictures, The Night is Young and You're So Beautiful, and many others. What you will not know, I think, is that she studied for 3 years, I didn't know the figure until just now, with Natalie Boulanger, and that a song like My Silent Love is indicative of another side of her career, which many people are not familiar with, because that was originally a theme in a jazz nocturne, which was premiered by Paul Whiteman and his orchestra at Carnegie Hall in one of those series of concerts, which really began with a premiere performance of Rhapsody in Blue of Gershwin's. She contributed to that important activity. She also wrote, again, for shows and events which were very much a part of my upbringing, and those of you who are old enough to be in my generation, that two or three people out there,
songs for the Casa Manana Reviews, for instance, which were at the Fort Worth Exposition in 1936 and 37, and for the Aquacade at the New York World's Fair, the Billy Rose Aquacade, which I actually saw and heard as a teenager. I will now help to the stage, I trust, around this way or that way, whichever way you'd like to come. Dana Suess.
Same tone as the A flat, the high A flat. It was simultaneous, but a different tone, a different note. And you would count those beats. And all great singers, when they hit those high notes, they usually had that. And I remember this very, very well. Excuse my frogs. I seem to be out with a slight sore throat this morning. There was later on a very fancy photograph called K-pop, which I'm sure you've heard of. Very, very expensive. It was sort of one of those custom built things. I suppose today they call it state of the art, but I never thought that. At any rate, there was a legend about the K-pops that they threw records at you. You could put something like 20 records on and it turned over automatically and so forth. But if you got temperamental, you didn't like what you were playing, you would throw things at you. I remember one time I was visiting the late Libby Holman in her country house in Connecticut, and she had a special room for the cake car, which she kept locked, and nobody could go in it but herself. Young Man with a Harp. I see that somebody here has an album of it. Yes. Well, I suppose that's what is known as a collector's album, collector's item. And I'd like to tell you a story about how that was made. First of all, in the old days of the recordings, we made them on big wax discs. They were about inch and a half thick. And you couldn't make a mistake, because if you did, you had to start all over again. And it was always an ordeal, especially for me. I hated making records. And when Gus Sherman Jr., the famous Sherman music company, decided to make records, I think his father gave him a record studio to play with, because he didn't want us to do them, Gus Jr. After hours, he made a recording of two albums. One was Blue Moonlight, which I played solo, various compositions of my own. And then the other album was Young Man with a Harp, which consisted, of course, of the famous Kathy Reardon, the great harpist who's now dead, and Chauncey Morehouse, the great percussionist, and myself playing a transcription of the orchestra part, because this had been written especially for Kathy Reardon to premiere with the Philadelphia Symphony some months previous. So the three of us assembled at the store, which was then on 43rd Street, between Fifth Avenue and Vanderbilt Avenue, I think. And Gus had hung a big red velvet curtain across about halfway across the store, the distance. It was hung from wall to wall, and it cut off the front half of the store. And behind that, it was kind of a makeshift studio with the proper equipment and all that, microphones. And so we started out after hours, after the store closed, we started about 6:30, I guess. Well, hour after hour went on, and if one of us didn't make a clinker, the other one would. Between three of us, or among three of us, there's always some mistake that simply we had to start over again, because I say these were the old days of recording. Well, around 7:30 or 8, Cassie and I got hungry, and we went across the street to Schratt's. And we were nervous and tired, and we ate probably something we shouldn't have, and we ate too fast, and we got back at the store, and shortly thereafter, we both began to have horrible stomach cramps, just felt awful. And along about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, we still hadn't, among the three of us, achieved a perfect shape. Finally, we went through it, and we got almost to the end, and everything was fine. Nobody had made any clinkers. We were so near and so keyed up that now we've made it, and all of a sudden the curtain fell down. But fortunately, we all had sense enough to keep going. I think when you're a pro, when things like that happen, you somehow know to have the writing things. So, when we got through and we heard the playback eventually, there was a slight little click that you may still hear, if you have an old record, you may still hear it. It's in the last movement. But it didn't make any great difference. But that's how it was born. I think that in some ways the child bearing must be worse. No, I mean to say just the other way around. I don't know what else you want to hear from me. I never kept any collection of my records. To me, songwriting was very fun and lovely to be successful at it. But I thought of it as a business, really. There were hundreds and hundreds, probably thousands of records made of various songs that I wrote for hits. But I never collected any of them. I may have five or six, seven, I don't know. Maybe the publisher sent me. But people I know have collected far more than I ever did. And there are lots and lots of records that I never heard. I didn't even know were in existence. And I think the first time I ever realized how many records have been made of our silent mothers when I went to ASCAP one day. And I had access to an enormous volume, about this thick, that had listings of all the recordings made, different songs, and to my astonishment, I saw that that my silent love had went on for columns and columns, and I never had realized that before. Excuse me, I must have a drink of water because I'm getting very dry. This is water, I think. Well, let's see, what else can we say? Freezing cold. blow out the sherry can before you go to the rehearsal where he knew Maggie would be. I don't know how much good it did, but we tried.
Did you work with Maddie Melnick?
I know that I must have known him, met him, and see, sooner or later when we were in that field, you met everybody. And at that time I was doing a lot of guest spots on all the big radio coast to coast shows. Chesterfield, I think Paul Whiteman had Chesterfield, and I did Camels and Lily Valley's show, and Atwater Kent, and what else? Oh, George Gershwin had a show, I think he had X-Lax. And let's see, well, you name it, they were all,
excuse me? It was
Fiegemann. The chewing gum wax. Oh, I thought it was X-Lax. Anyway, all these important coast-to-coast broadcasts on the big networks, I did them all. As a matter of fact, I also did the General Motors Sympathy concert series, and I was the only other American composer besides Gershwin to be invited to play. And my symphonic waltzes for piano and orchestra were played on that occasion.
Dana, yes. You made music roles?
Yes, I did make a couple. I've completely forgotten what they were, and on the occasion of what I thought was my swan song in Carnegie Hall in 1974, Pino Minton came to New York for the concert, and he brought with him these roles, and I had quite forgotten about them. I think they were made for, a dual arm, I think. I'm not sure.
There will be a question period later, and I think we have some notes there that you haven't got to yet.
Oh, well, not terribly many.
It's up to you entirely to take questions out if you like. I just.
I remember making a record at, I think, the Pipeline of the Victor at the old Leader Crowns Hall, which was a famous place. I'm sure many of you must know about it. It was selected because the acoustics were so wonderful there. Speaking of acoustics, of course, there's no place like Carnegie Hall. Let's see what else we have. Oh, there were some records that I remember from my childhood that were quite interesting. I think there were Harry Lauder records made, and I think, I'm not sure, but I think the Two Black Crows. I think we got a record of that. They recorded a great many of them, a great deal of a great diversity of things, besides opera. Of course, we had some comic records and opera and so forth. I mean, some charming operetta records, the Victor Herbert operettas of the Red Mill. And there was something that I remember very well called In the Garden Monastery, or the Monastery Garden. Yes. And I've forgotten who wrote it now.
Tell me.
Yeah. And we had quite a collection. I wonder what ever became of them.
Somebody here has got them.
It must be worth a lot of money. I remember Gally Kirchy singing Lo, Here the Gentle Lark. And The Wren, I think the song, the color cure song called The Wren. And Louise Homer, I remember we had records of her. We had records of Schoenheim. We had Fadorovsky. We had Rachmaninoff. And let's see what else. That's about all I think. I talked about Caruso. Of course, we had the famous Pagliacci Harriet. McCormick, we loved my grandmother, who was Irish, Scots-Irish. She loved McCormick. And one of her favorite records was Meditation from Thais. And another one was Promenade. Quietly, we loved. So I remember those records very, very well. That was the beginning rock, 1920, 21. And that's, let's see, well, that's over 60 years ago. So, but I remember things even further back than that, but no rock telling you them.
Well, perhaps we could now meet the third member of our panel, and then we will have questions afterward for all three.
I just want to say that due to a number of people who have liked my music, I am very much indebted to those who have, like Peter Minton, who have recorded and taped for me things that I had lost and had no record of. And I'm sure that there must be among you many of those tapes. And I'm very grateful that people have taken the trouble to do this. Thank you very much. Yeah.
If you two would bear with us and be seated, and then at the end we can have questions for all three if you can. The third member of this illustrious panel, I am sure, would be known as a major theater writer, stage and screen director, producer, playwright, had he never touched a popular song directly or had anything to do with one. But on the other hand, he had to do with, for one example, the first song that ever won an Academy Award in that category, Carioca, from Flying Down to Rio. He wrote, again, for John Murray Anderson's Almanac, that illustrious series of shows, time after time. And among his songs, among the songs which he was associated with as lyricist, is for me one of the absolute great American songs, bar none, which is More Than You Know, a song that is so good that its verse is almost a song in itself. If you know the verse, if you don't, you should. This is Mr. Edward Eliscu. Thank you.
While I'm being pinned up, I just want to...
First man I ever pinned.
I'm pinned but not pledged. I want to say that after Gerald Marks, that's a tough act to follow. And Dana Swees has been so interesting and eloquent about her memories that if I take my cello out of my pocket and you hear the same melody being played as was played by both the speakers before me, you'll understand why. After reading the impressive schedule of events for this conference, I've concluded that either I'm here by mistake or that I'm being recognized for longevity. I share the experience that Dana Swees related. Somebody must have suspected that as a boy, I used to wind up the family Victrola by hand to hear Caruso sing a Red Seal recording of Una Furtiva Lagrima. Certainly, there is little that I, who still use a manual typewriter, can contribute to this technological gathering. But ASCAP has thrust me before you, and it brings me to another occasion when I faced a captive audience like you. During World War II in Hollywood, a young singer slated to perform some of my songs, was stricken with laryngitis after having performed at war bond rallies all day. Well, I was rushed into the breach and drafted to sing before an audience of movie notables, including Bing Crosby, Danny Kaye, directors, producers, the works. Well, I did step into the breach, and I sang my heart out. I finished to a very gratifying round of applause, and I was especially delighted to see Tallulah Bankhead hurrying toward me with outstretched arms. She embraced me, looked me in the eye, and said, "Eddie, darling, what courage." Since then, I've developed more courage, though I don't think my singing has improved, and I'm an a cappella fellow. To return to the agenda, the program announced this group from ASCAP as representing Tin Pan Alley. Now, that's really a misnomer. If Fred Fisher, Al Piantedosi, Maceo Pinkard, Ballad MacDonald, and 100 others were alive, they would typify Tin Pan Alley more appropriately than the group today. Naturally, Mr. Popular Music himself, Irving Berlin, is alive, and we salute him.
A couple of minutes, the business meeting, we just have to reshuffle some things. Our attendance has been good at the session so far. Let's make sure that we all are here for the business meeting as well. There are some very important things that are going to be discussed.